The world has gone insane. Cosplayers rule the conventions. Gamers dominate the tabletop and the internet. Sci-fi subjugates the movies, and fantasy rules the bookstore with an iron fist. Only one group can bring order to this unruly mob. A team of uber geeks, masters of the nerdly arts, trained for decades in the hobby shops and basements of the nation. Mobilized by the secret masters, they are the Department of Nerdly Affairs.
Hello, operatives, and welcome to the Department of Nerdly Affairs. I'm your host, Rob Patterson, here with my co-host, Don Chisholm.
A wise website once said, you can't spell failure without URA.
Okay. And as Don has indicated, tonight we're going to talk about failure. We're going to talk about our greatest creative failures and what we've learned from them. And to help us console our broken hearts, we've brought in one of our dearest and nearest friends, Jack Ward. Welcome back to the show, Jack.
Thank you very much. I'm just sitting here on the couch, ready to open up and tell you all about my failures. I'm kind of concerned that I was brought in when you thought of failures.
So. it was happenstance, Jack. It was totally happenstance.
That's right.
The real reason we had to bring you back is, of course, is this is actually a very special episode. This is actually our 100th episode.
Wow, that's amazing. Congratulations, guys.
Thank you very much.
And I've listened to all 100.
Wow, no, we should be thanking you. The fact that you got through all 100, dude, that's an accomplishment.
Well, I mean, when this one comes out, it will be all 100, to be fair, right?
Right, well, that's true. Well, actually, technically, this is not our 100th episode. This would actually be our 102nd-ish episode, because we did the usual podcaster thing where we actually recorded a couple that we never aired.
Were those some of your failures that you're going to talk about?
That wasn't part of the plan, but I suppose we could. I mean, we originally did, I believe it was 2 practice episodes before we did something that we considered even worth putting on the air, which is, of course, pretty scary if you listen to our first episode. Please, folks, don't. Just save yourself a lot of trouble. Don't listen to it. And then we had another episode along the way that we recorded, and then we just decided, that episode just wasn't very good. So we just never put it out there. And then on top of that, there's actually 2, I don't know what to call them. There's actually 2 B episodes. Like there were 2 episodes that were so long, we divided them into 2 parts, and there's part A and part B, and they were aired separately. So that's so whether you count those as a single episode or double episodes, that's up to you. So
I thought you were saying they're B-side episodes, and the only way you can listen to them is if you flip your podcaster over on the other side of the 45.
Once again, even though we've been at this for like about 3 years, your experience as a longtime podcaster is totally showing, because that would have been awesome to see if we could get any of our listeners to actually flip over their like phones or something like that to listen to the other side.
That'd be amazing.
That's a brilliant idea.
Of course, what's interesting right now, there's like a bunch of people going, what are they talking about?
There's a secret recording, folks. Just flip your phone over and it'll change. Trust me.
That's right.
You have to flip it over.
But be careful. I was just going to say, be careful. Flip it facing yourself or it will run backwards.
That's exactly right. And you wouldn't want to have that happen. Want that to have. Wait, what?
Yeah, because that screws up your needle when you listen to it backwards.
Exactly. But, you know, everyone pretty much talks about how they've done these amazing things in their 100th episode and how they're so proud of their show. And, yeah, they talk about their highlights and everything. So us being the iconoclastic individuals that we are, we thought we'd talk about some of our creative failures instead. Some of the stuff that just didn't work out. Because just because we reached 100 doesn't mean it was easy. And nothing worth doing ever is, and there's always a bunch of failures in the can before you get there. Just as we mentioned, even this show, we did some practice episodes first. And that's just the way it is. So there's an interesting question, Jack. So how many years have you been doing the Sonic Society?
The Sonic Society will be 15 seasons, so it's 15 years starting September.
Wow. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you so much. Wow. I consider myself one of the longest running podcasters out there at this point.
I think you are. I mean, you're up there. There is Slate's Political Gab Fest, which I know was running around 2005-ish, so it would have started around the same time you did.
Yeah.
But as far as like indie podcasts and everything like you are, yeah, you're probably one of the longest running. Wow.
I know Mysterious Universe has been going probably the same amount of time, but they call themselves like 22 seasons at this point. Because at one point they just started splitting up the years into two parts. So they have more effectively seasons, but I like keeping it as a year a season. It's easier to keep track of.
I think so too. I think, don't they do that now? Doesn't Mysterious Universe usually, each quote-unquote year is one season, they take a break in the summer or something like that, and then they come back and do their new season?
I think they switch the seasons at the end of the year as well, so it's like 6 months long.
Oh, it's okay. They're doing five or 6 months. I think they only do about 5 months, don't they? And then they take a break for a little bit, and then they come back.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is fair, considering how much content they put out.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
Because they just started a new season.
Yes, they did.
This week.
Yep.
But to be fair, it is their full-time job. It is their full-time occupation, and they adore it. So if you had full-time occupation time and it was paying for everything, you would put out that much content too. Because really, it's, what is it, two shows a week?
Yeah, they put in two shows a week. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's it. And so the one for the subscribers and the one for the non-paying customers. And Mysterious Universe is, quality-wise, is awesome. And but they spend pretty much the whole week just researching for their shows. Those guys must be like the most well-read individuals on the planet.
It's amazing how many books they've read, and amazing how many books I bought based upon stuff that they've talked about. You know, like, where else would I find a book on deep sea diving by Japanese women back in the 40s? But fascinating stuff. Like, these women go down 300 feet and stuff like that. And anyway, it's a great show for that particular reason. But they're pikers, let's be honest. Since I started Mutual Audio Drama, I've been doing 2 to 3 shows a day since the beginning of March.
Wow. So
I have eight different feeds going on.
Wow. It's not like you're hosting every one of those shows, are you, Jack?
You're right. I'm not creating content for every one of those days. But people are. There are times that I'm doing the introduction. There's always somebody doing a new introduction, and we're taking a lot of old shows. But every Sunday, I'm still doing the Sonic Society, so I'm still doing that on top of what I used to do as well. And oftentimes, I'm still putting in new shows that I'm doing, and Sonic Speaks and Sonic Echo. And so there's a bunch of different shows that I try to put in, so at least I do a new show, effectively a new show or two new shows a week. So
Right. Wow. Hmm. Okay, so in all that time, what would you consider your greatest creative failures, Jack, in all the stuff that you've been doing? Because there must be a couple in there somewhere.
In alphabetical order?
Well, okay, we don't have all night, so try to keep the list short, okay? We're just talking about your top ones.
Okay, so the most painful one is, I won't name the person involved, but I had a co-host who I happened to have been dating for about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And who had also starred in about 80% of my shows.
Right.
And when we broke up, she said, "I want them all gone. Everything that I was in, I want it gone."
Right.
And so my biggest failure there is not having a release document for people to sign. And I'm just a simple guy who's thinking, well, we're not making any money on this, it's just for fun, why do we have to get all legal and stuff like that? Folks, listen to me, get legal, you know what I mean? So I've actually paid in Mutual, I've paid for 3 different kinds of releases, including a compensation release and a release that's just for fun for people. And I'm giving them for free to people who are Mutual members if they ever want to use them for their own, because you don't need to go through that. Now, the benefit about what happens, like, this was a painful, painful process to sit there and think most of my creative works would just disappear. Mm. I had the amazing Tanya Malevich, which I know you know.
I worked with her way back when she was first starting out a little bit. Yeah.
And she's like, I call her the queen of audio drama, because I think she's like the modern day Agnes Moorehead. And she said to me, like, I was talking to her about this, and she said, no, is this isn't happening. I said, what do you mean? And she said, I don't care if I have to punch in every single line this person did. You're not losing all your works. We're going to remake everything.
Hmm. Wow.
And so she put her own stuff aside and just worked. She and another friend, Josh Price, who works with her, they both produced a lot of my shorts. We redid a lot of the large shows. And here's the honest truth. As good as that actress was who I went out with, and she's a phenomenal actress. And by the way, I still have no ill will toward her. I wish she didn't want this, but I understand that some people feel this way after the ending of a relationship, and that's the way it is. So I have no ill will towards her personally. But this stuff came out better the second time.
Right.
It's because I'm a better producer. I'm a better director now. You know, I've taken all these great scripts that I did, and now there's some better acting in there and better productions and better performances. So as painful as that process was, and it took a couple of years to go and replace stuff, it worked out in the end. But boy, that was the most miserable time.
Oh, I bet. Wow. I bet that was. Now, when you say go back and replace, do you mean just go back and re-edit them to replace her lines and then do it that way? Because weren't some of those shows done live effectively?
Well, that's the thing. There's one show that starred both of us, which was a comedy show, which will be gone forever. It, you know, obviously it can't replace
that
it.
Can't
because
be,
her name is in the show, for crying out loud. so that's the sad part, because that was a lot of people's favorites, including a lot of my actors' favorites. They used to say, you know what show I love the most? It was this. And I think they loved it because it was such off the cuff. I was they would come in and I would still be writing the script, because I'd be doing two or three scripts for them to come in and record. And so they would, you know, this person would, you know, they would have to entertain themselves for 15 minutes while I, you know, finished the last couple of lines and printed out three copies off of my printer for people to read. So it was fun. But the truth of the matter is that other than that, there were some shows where she was just like a line or two and we could punch in and fix those ones. And there were some that she was a main role in. And so we totally redid those. So one of my first Mark Time Awards. So both her and David Ault were in an amazing show, and that worked out great. So but hey, like I said, no regrets in that respect. There's just I'm always about learning and growing. So even the worst failures, there's something you can learn from.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, why don't we take some heat off Jack for a moment, Don, and talk about you. Let Jack cry in a corner for a minute it's okay, Jack. They're there.
We're here for you, man. We're here for you.
DNA therapy.
Exactly. Well, you know, after 100 episodes, it's kind of the way it goes.
Yeah, for sure.
So Don, what would you say is one of your greatest creative failures, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, I think if you want to talk failure, I'd have to say everything I've ever done, really.
Okay, we might be here for a while, folks.
Ta-da!
So why don't you explain?
I don't know. It goes with the idea of how do you define failure and success?
Which is an excellent point. Maybe we should have started with that, but that's just the way it worked out. Okay, so how do you define failure and success, Don?
Well, I think there's if you're, especially if you're talking about creative endeavors, there's kind of two things that you can look at. And I think one would be success with, say, audience and money.
Right.
And one would be success within the project itself. Like, did you do something that is very worthwhile, that adds something to the human experience, that sort of thing?
Okay. I think those are good ways to look at both of those things, because yes, there's, I mean, you could even put a third category in, which is basically how you felt it turned out.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that too would include how you reconcile the two.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, that's true. So it's kind of that triangle there. So if we look at it that way, okay, so if that's the way you look at failure, then how do you reconcile or look at your creative failures or not?
Well, it's It's tough to say because I've burned out a couple times.
And I'm not sure if I would consider that failure, really. I mean, you made an honest effort and you tried and... Okay, why don't we go back? Did we actually ever do an Akrima City episode?
No.
I think that's probably... This is probably why. so I think maybe because this is episode 100, it's time to do our Akrima City episode in a way.
Yikes.
We don't have to if you don't want to, dude. If you're not comfortable with it, if you're not comfortable with it, we don't have to go there. In fact, I can chop some of this stuff out. It's not a problem. But I'm just thinking that if they're going to understand, because I know where all this is going, of course. I was there for pretty much all of it, or at least a good chunk of it anyway. So if this is where we're going, you're going to have to explain Akrima City.
Okay. Well, it's the idea, like, because we've talked before. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a difference between, say, me and, like, you and Jack.
Right.
Like, you and Jack are writers. Mm-hmm. You're directors, you're producers. And what I mean by that is you're developing those skills. Like, you write to write, and you write about different things.
Yeah.
My problem was always that I had a story.
Right.
That I didn't want to be a game designer, I didn't want to be a cartoonist. I had a story, and this was the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. That kind of runs into the problem. This is where I say you can look at the two different ways of measuring success. Mm-hmm. Because nothing I ever did really made the temporal success. There weren't millions of fans. I usually lost money on anything I did. Mm-hmm. And... the problem that I got, because I'm so focused on doing one thing, like I can see in my head what it's supposed to be like.
Right.
And it never quite ends up on the page. And part of the problem is because as you develop a skill, you can cognate things better.
Right.
And it feels like what goes on in my head, what this, how this story should play out, how this character should look, et cetera, et cetera, is always one or two steps ahead of what I can physically create.
Right. Yeah, I can see that, especially from an artist's point of view, where your drawing skills are always a step behind where you really want them to be.
Yeah, and it can kind of get to you after a bit. Because no matter what you do, and this is why I think a lot of like great artists drink and die early, is that no matter how good you are, there's always that something better. You're always chasing something. And I find you a lot of, if you're a commercial artist, you can take solstice in like success, fan-wise, money-wise. You can take solstice if you're like a mercenary artist type, like a lot of people work in television or that.
Right.
You can take solstice in how you manage to polish up that turd that the executives forced upon you. And that's a great achievement, too.
Yes, it is.
But
when it's your own project.
Yeah, like it's there's always, because like I say, I think it's that problem that you're always looking at something more, that you're always thinking, and you guys might know that you finish something like, this is awesome, and then you look at it again and it's like, no, that sucks and that's wrong and that's bad and that didn't turn out.
Yes, I could see that. I mean, but that's what revision editing is for, and there is something to be said for just getting it the hell out there, like, and moving on. I mean, I understand what you're talking about. There's really kind of two ways to deal with at least some of what you're talking about. For example, many writers, you know, have a story they want to tell, okay? And I've noticed that one thing that a lot of writers do, now I'm referring to novel writers mostly here, but they tend to take one of two approaches. They either basically tell different versions of the same story over and over again, where what they're doing is they're slowly improving their skill level as they go. So each version ends up being better. They're, you know, they have different names for the characters and everything, but ultimately it's the same story. They just keep retelling. And that can work for them. That's a way to, so there's, as their skill level goes up, they do that. Or there's the other way where you get stuck in almost a loop where you basically keep going back and redoing what you did before. And it prevents you from going forward.
And to be fair, some very famous writers spend a lot of time repurposing their, not repurposing, but going back to their work and fixing stuff. And a lot of producers do that. Like, I mean, that was, people were complaining so much about George Lucas, right? Just having yet another version of Star Wars because he wasn't happy with the last one, right?
So. Right.
Yeah.
Or not making enough money from it, as the case may be.
Could be it too, right? It could be those two things. But I think honestly, I think Lucas is a bit of a perfectionist. And I think that he, because every time he talks about even the shows that don't do well, he's already thought about what he wished he could have done better. Like, what was the one, the flying tiger ones?
Red Tails.
Oh. He has all kinds of complaints about what he wished he could have done. He wanted to make that a full series, right? And I kind of enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty cool, but it didn't hit for some reason or another, right?
Actually,
and
I didn't like it that much. I wasn't that impressed by it.
Oh, it wasn't fantastic, but I kind of enjoyed it because I hadn't heard that story before. That's the thing, right? So.
Right. Okay, that's true. But didn't actually, because it's the Tuskegee Airmen, if I remember right, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yes.
And if I remember right, didn't an actual movie called The Tuskegee Airmen come out around the same time as Red Tails that was actually supposed to be a lot better?
I didn't notice that, so maybe
that was it. I didn't see the other one, but supposedly, I know there's a movie called The Tuskegee Airmen about them that came out not too short, before or after Red Tails. I don't remember which. And so that story did get told by another set, and everyone talked about that version of the story much better than they did Red Tails. Red Tails only got noticed, really, because, you know, Lucas did it. And then a lot of people said, guess he should have stuck with Star Wars. But sadly, I think Lucas is one of those guys that he had his peak, and then I don't think he's really done anything seriously creative since then that actually is, how can I put this, all that good, really.
I think he's more of a technician than he is a writer. You know what I mean?
I would agree with that.
He's much more of a good producer than he was a writer. If somebody had a fantastic script, the problem is, like I said, he wants to control everything. So if somebody brought him a script, he'd more likely rewrite it to make it worse than make it better for that reason.
True.
And so, you know, people need to know their lane, right? and I'm not trying to say that in a woke fashion or any kind of thing like that. I'm just trying to say that once you know what you're good at, it's difficult to break out of those and be respected for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. People like me are really lucky because I'm good at nothing, so I can do anything and nobody has high expectations.
So you're basically saying that you're Ed Wood?
Ed Wood's more talented than I am. He's excellent at being bad. I'm not even that good at being bad, really. You know, my stuff isn't Ed Wood bad in any way, shape, or form. That takes a certain kind of expertise to be that awful. Think about it. It really does. Like, I've seen people who try to make really bad B-flick like shows, and they don't land. They just get boring. Ed Wood's not really boring through his stuff. You can laugh like crazy through some of his stuff.
But the thing is, he was 100% serious when he made it. He wasn't trying to make bad things. He thought he was making good things.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That's the madness of it all, right? Because there's this brilliance in how bad he is and not knowing it. That's the thing, because I think when people try to do something and they know it's going to be bad, they fail.
That's true. That's very true.
The
worst stuff can only be made by people who are honestly trying to make something good.
Right.
Yeah.
Just like the worst deeds are often committed by people who are honestly trying to do something good.
Yeah.
The road to hell and all that.
Exactly.
Sorry to get philosophical in a second. So, okay, Don, let's go back to you for a second. You're not out of the, you're not out of the chair yet here. So let's take a different tact. If you were to go back and be able to give a lecture to your, we'll say, 16-year-old self about what to do and what not to do, what would you tell your 16-year-old self?
If you're talking about pertaining to, like, the comic and the game, I'd have to go back further.
Okay, earlier, fine. Don't stop being picky. Come on, just spit it out.
Well, this is the thing, because I was about 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
When I started it, and it's kind of disturbing to think that it germinated since then.
Right.
But it would be hard to do anything different. Cause like I say, it's a specific like story. It's it's not that I'd say, do this, talk to this guy, go here, learn how to do more of that, don't do this. Because it all kind of had to play out the way it did, because it's
don't entirely agree with that statement. As someone who was there for some of it and have watched you struggle with it over the years, that's not quite true. Okay. I think that if you had probably maybe had a mentor or had someone that actually could have guided you a little bit back in the day, I'm not sure who exactly, but you might have actually been able to get a leg up on things and get a little more control over your artistic ability and storytelling ability. If you had someone who could have actually gotten you to when you were willing to actually start producing some of this stuff and getting it out there, whether it was good, bad, or whatever, just to get it out, I think you would have benefited a lot back in the day.
Maybe, but this is the weird thing, because I did, but all of the people that I learned stuff from, they weren't cartoonists, they were fine artists.
Right.
And it's where I learned an important lesson. If you want to be any kind of an artist, there's sort of two ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you want to make it your profession.
Right, right.
And that is, you can develop a passable amount of technical skill and then sort of just do what the thing everybody's doing is.
Yes.
Or you can be so super awesome that you just come in and whatever you do, you wow everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then that's the problem. Because, like, for me, I was never super awesome. I was always, like, passable.
Mm-hmm.
But because I was doing this one thing and I wanted, like, I see it a certain way, it doesn't look like anything else.
Yes, that's true. That's very true.
And then so I can't do the first method. Because that was the thing with the comic I always laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a superhero fan reading it, they said, oh, this is like the Japanese stuff. It was a Japanese fan reading it, they'd be like, oh, this is like the superhero stuff. Oh, this is fantastic.
Yeah, well, pretty much. And do you want to actually tell our audience in non-coded language what you're talking about? You've been dancing around it for a while. You might as well tell
what
them
you're
about
saying is tell Jack. Tell Jack. He's the one who's here.
Exactly. Because I know all this stuff, Don, obviously. The audience, but the audience, and Jack is our audience surrogate here, has no idea what the hell you're talking about.
Well, I'm not exactly sure I know what you're getting at.
What I'm basically saying is, what's the damn story?
Well, it's another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not humans. And the idea from the beginning was that I wanted to do a generic setting.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, like, the game was probably what went over the best, so I'll talk mostly about the game, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted a generic setting, mm-hmm, where even though it's this weird cartoony, science fiction-y, fantasy-looking thing,
mm-hmm,
you could do any kind of story you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And pertaining to, say, role-playing games, a lot of companies claim to have a universal system, but what it generally means is you can kill the bad guy with a machine gun or a magic spell or psychic powers.
Yep.
But you're still doing an adventure story, and I wanted something that if you wanted to, say, do a soap opera, you could.
Right.
If you wanted to do, like, a wacky sitcom, you could do that. You could do that in the game.
Right.
So it became... It was that idea, and this is where I think I've mentioned before that a lot of science fiction stuff cheeses me off because they don't think through the setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I did that, and they did all the little fiddly bits, and it's designed so that it's and this is, again, it's hard to explain. You can't do an elevator pitch with this exactly, unless I want to lie.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've done. I've gone places trying to do a TV show, and I've totally, like, I'll say fibbed about what's going on.
Well, but what's the... Okay, let's not worry about the setting. Yes, you've got a very detailed setting. What is the hook that sells this? Go.
Well, see, that's the problem, though, because it didn't sell.
Well, okay, and again, in theory, you tried to use to sell it. Come on, dude, you're hedging like crazy on this one.
Well, I'm trying to think, because, again, it wasn't one series. There was a bunch of different ones, but they all take place in the same setting.
Okay, but what's the primary one?
Well, the Akrima City one.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to get you to say. Okay.
And it's like a science fiction-y kind of thing.
Okay. Can you be more specific?
The main series was basically what you'd get if you did a science fiction-y action story as a drama.
Okay.
That it gets into the why. It's a society that, like, Akrima City is a utopia.
Okay, there we go. So you got a utopian setting, right? Okay, keep going.
But the underlying theme was, what price do you pay for that?
Okay, there we go. So keep going.
And it was the idea that Akrimans aren't quite human.
Mm-hmm.
In that they're more, I guess, laid back. I used to describe them as good-natured plebes.
Okay.
And that's kind of what makes things tick. And the idea was they start having these weird crimes happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because you get people who don't quite fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And in this well-organized society with enough super science that if you go nuts, you can take a lot of people with you.
Right.
And the gist of it was there was a lot of action, but you got more into kind of the reasons behind it because you'd look at it from somebody's point of view. Sometimes it'd be the hero. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it'd be the villain. Sometimes it'd be a character who was both.
Okay. So the main story is basically about the sort of breakdown of society in this utopian setting. And would you argue that it's partly about why utopias don't work?
No, it's and that's what one of the things that, again, if you do a utopian setting, everybody's waiting for it to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, it doesn't collapse. It's a genuine utopia. It's just that it points out that idea that you're always going to have people that fall off the edge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is why I'd say it's more of a drama than a lot of stuff, because a lot of the villains, especially us, could really sympathize with, because a lot of the villains tend to be more like us.
Right. Okay, so they're the people that don't fit into this perfectly well-adjusted society.
Yeah, and then it's that question of what do you do with the people that don't fit in?
Okay, there we go. See, that wasn't that hard. See, there we go. So we have. So this is your story. It's about what do you do with the people that don't fit in, and you're taking looking at it from different angles with some science fiction, some action thrown in. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what made this so hard for you to actually get out there? Since I know you did tons of little like mini comics and plans and things like that, and you've done stories. You've done outlines of stories anyway. What made this such a challenge to get out there for you?
Well, part of it was like back in the day, and this is why it's funny because I know a lot of really obsolete printing techniques.
Okay.
Because back in the day, it was the thing, because things got out. There's different stories and little booklets and that got out. But
I know I've got some of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could never get anybody to pick it up, and I think part of it was because it's not something that exactly looks like something else.
Right.
And I didn't have the chops to just, well, here's my stuff. Just eat it, bitches. You love me. You know, I could never pull that off. And the problem that you ran into is you bust your ass working and working and working and practice, 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 practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you still don't get anywhere. So you're not right. Making a living doing this. And then that breaks your heart, because if you're making a living doing it, you could put more time into it rather than having to work like two other jobs to pay the bills.
Right.
And then it's that idea that on a personal level, as you get better at writing and drawing and composing, you can cognate different things. And then, like I say, it always feels like you're kind of falling behind there.
Right.
And then eventually you kind of burn out. Like the thing that sort of killed me the first time was after spending an exorbitant amount of time working on this and practicing and developing. There was a friend of my mom's that her kid ended up becoming an actual, he's not like a super famous cartoonist, but he's a good solid B-lister. If I mentioned his name, you'd know who I was talking about. And he ended up, practiced for a year, taught himself to draw like the currently popular guy at the time, got hired right away, and then that was his career.
Right, yeah.
And I remember talking to him about it, and his exact reason for getting into comics was, and I quote, "It beats getting a real job."
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I can totally see that.
And then, like I say, that kind of, you gotta, and then that's the other side of failure. There's learning from failure, mm-hmm. and there's at which point do you pack it in?
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, there is that, I don't remember, there's a name for that fallacy, where sunk cost fallacy, there it is, where you just, mm-hmm. you say, well, I've put in 20 years in this, I might as well keep going at it, mm-hmm. which is a fallacy because, no, that's not logical. I mean, if it's not, hasn't worked for 20 years, maybe you should just quit. So that, right. not that I'm telling you to quit. I'm just saying that there's, I can see your logic where you're just like, you know, screw it. I've had enough. And so you burnt out. And then mm-hmm. I know since then you've tried a couple other times. You every now mm-hmm. and then you get the creative urge. And so you go back into it again. And a big part of it for you has been the game, which yeah. you did as a way to kind of a side project to help deal with your creative drives and things like that. You're like, well, okay, so I'll do a game version of it, which I know is almost ready to go.
Yeah, it's the rules. Well, the game was different because the game was coming up with like the comic in the setting. I thought everything through mm-hmm. To the point that if you look at the background and you see stars, mm-hmm. you'll probably notice patterns because I did actual star charts for the stars of the world.
Right.
And the game was a way of taking all of these really nifty things that nobody cared about because it didn't involve a car chase mm-hmm. and bringing them to life.
Yep.
Because there's a lot of things that over the years, nobody ever questioned. And I thought about the two that came to readily to mind was number one, mm-hmm. how are you wearing nylons over fur? Number two, if the ears are on the top of your head, why are the headphones on the side?
By the way, folks, I should tell you that the Akreemans, the people he's talking about in this setting, are basically little furry animal cat people. Mm-hmm. That's why that's coming up. I don't think that's come up during this podcast so far. That was one of those things you kind of danced around. You said they're not human, but you didn't actually explain what they look like. So they're vaguely cat people, ish, yes. sort of. Exactly. Okay. And you thought that stuff through. So actually, you could make a very good argument then that you turned your creative failure on the comic side into what may still be creative success on the gaming side. I mean, I have read your rules and I've even run your game many years ago. I ran one of the earlier versions of it. And you put together a very solid role-playing game with a very interesting and unique setting. And you took all those creative ideas that you put together for the comic and you actually turn them into a game instead, a one that is actually quite unique and that you really do need to get out there in the near future if you can, because I think some of our audience members would probably really be interested in checking it out.
Maybe, because this is why, like Jack was talking about at George Lucas, and I can empathize because I think Lucas has the problem that I do, mm-hmm. that he has really good ideas, but doesn't necessarily have the skills to translate those into a format that other people who don't live in his head would really understand.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. I'm kind of on the same trajectory in some ways at the moment. Not too long ago, I published a book on writing shonen manga, and I've also published a book on writing called All the Right Moves, etc. Mm. And those books were the result of me basically realizing that I had lots of great ideas, but I still didn't have the skill to actually write those stories that I wanted to, and that I couldn't reach the audience that I wanted to. And so as an end result, I began studying writing. And as a teacher, I've learned one of the best ways to actually truly ingrain something in your psyche and to actually truly know if you understand it is to teach it.
Yes.
Sure. So I basically wrote writing books to teach myself to write.
But that begs an important question then. What's your biggest failure?
Ah, okay. Well, that's where I was headed with this. So thank you. Thanks for the segue, Don. Funny you should ask. The answer would probably be Kung Fu Action Theater. My audio drama broadcast, I would actually consider my greatest creative failure in some ways.
Now, which some you might can hear right now in Mutual Audio Network, Kung Fu Action exactly. Theater, which, by the way, a lot of people still quite love. Twin Stars is playing on Wednesday Wonders, in fact, right now.
So. Yep. Yeah, thank you, Jack. And I know many people do enjoy it. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I first started doing audio drama and first got into audio drama, I decided I wanted to do it, and I was very careful about it, and I'm like, but I had no real experience like writing audio drama or writing scripts or any of that stuff. And so I basically said, well, I'm just going to give it a go. One of my good friends, Graham, actually, at the time I talked to him, and he said, dude, you're not getting paid for any of this. You're just sticking stuff out there. Do whatever the hell you want. Maybe not exactly in those words. He's a little more erudite than that. But the point is that he basically, he has just said, don't worry about it. Just as long as you're not getting paid, just do whatever you want. And that was that's the philosophy I took to heart. And so when I did Twin Stars, well, we'll get to Twin Stars in a minute. When I did Kung Fu Action Theater, I basically just did whatever I thought was fun. I was just literally making this stuff up as I went along, just kind of randomly, creatively trying stuff. Now, I wasn't completely stupid. I did start with one-shots, the Little Go Adventures, which worked out pretty well, actually, because they proved to be a good training ground. And in fact, if you listen to the Little Go Adventures that I did, or the Adventures of Little Go, you will actually literally hear my very first and my very last audio drama are part of the 10 or 11 Little Go stories that I did. And and so you can literally hear the progression as a producer and as a director. Well, because that was the thing, right? I didn't have anyone to help me back in those days. I wasn't fortunate enough, and I was originally stuck over in Taiwan when I started it. So therefore, I taught myself how to mix. I taught myself how to upload stuff, RSS feeds, write, direct, act, the whole shebang. And so it was my literal creative process. It was me trying to be the one-man audio drama crew. I was just trying to follow my hero, Jack Ward, of course. and that's not quite an exaggeration, because I was literally listening to Jack Ward and saying, you know, this dude is doing it. That Greg Taylor guy is doing it. I can do it too. And little did I know how hard it really was and how much effort those guys were putting in. They were really amazing back in the day, and they still are now. But anyway, my point is, so I did that, and then I thought, okay, I can try something a little more. So I did Team Iron Angel, which I'm still really fond of. I actually, it's a quasi-radio play in the sense that it's almost a first-person novel, but with voices in it and almost no exposition.
And you can hear it in Saturday Story Circle going on right now, too.
Exactly, if you want to hear that. And I'm actually still rather proud of that one. That one I'm actually proud of.
Yeah, it was a great show.
Because I thought it turned out pretty well. Again, making it up as I went along, I nearly took several different versions of it, and I even wanted to do more of it. There actually is supposed to be more Team Iron Angel, but I just never got around back to it. Because I started, once I was done Team Iron Angel, I said, you know, I can do something bigger than this. And I've always wanted to do a star-spanning space opera. I'm going to do one called Twin Stars. And this is where my greatest creative failure came in the sense that I was not really capable of doing Twin Stars when I did it. Now, some people might disagree. Some people might say, but Rob, we love Twin Stars. And there's no question it was Kung Fu Action Theater's most popular show.
Right.
But at the same time, I always felt that, again, I was just kind of making it up as I went along. And I kind of burnt out. I reached a creative point with it. That's why it ends where it does after two seasons. Is okay. That I literally reached the point where I wasn't capable of carrying the story on anymore. I mean, I gave lots of excuses like, well, you know, I want to turn it into a book, or I want, which I did, or I want to just take a break and I'll get back to it and such. But the truth of the matter is that I really didn't know what to do with the story anymore. I knew, much like Dawn, I knew actually where the story was supposed to go, and I knew where it was end, but I had no ability to get it there. What I'd done is I'd written the beginning of a really, really great epic space opera. But as soon as I finished the beginning of it, I couldn't follow through. I couldn't do the middle anymore. Because I did several drafts. I honestly did give it a lot of try and even kept picking away at it over the years and trying to figure it out. And now I can probably do it, and I may still, but I couldn't do it as an audio drama at the time. I'd reached my skill level, and I always regret that because I had built up quite the fan base. I mean, I had thousands and thousands of people listening to it every episode that came out, even back in the day. And I had all these fans. I had people literally offering to send me money to make more of it.
That's awesome.
I had people that literally, it's like, how much do you want me to give you? How much do you want to donate? How much of my time do you want to help edit? How can I become an actor in this? You would not believe how many different offers of support I got, and God knows, I still occasionally get some today. I've still literally had people come to me and say, look, I will give you X amount of money to just continue Twin Stars because I want to know how it turns out.
That's amazing.
And I'd never accept it because I don't know if or when I'm going to be able to finish it. And I definitely won't be able to finish it as an audio drama. I mean, at this point, it's been, let's see, I finished, what, about 2013, I think it is. So about six or so years since it stopped. All of my actors have moved on at this point.
That was weird. Sorry, one of the things I noticed as I'm listening to it is that there's a bunch of actors that don't really have names. They sound like they're like screen names for AIM or ICU or something like that.
That's because they're actors from the Voice Acting Alliance.
Oh, okay. And so they come off, they don't want to use their real names?
That's exactly right.
Why is that?
Well, I think back in the law, almost all of them are teenagers. Okay. With a few exceptions like David Ault, for example, or Fiona Thrale. Most of them are teenagers. This was one of their very first acting gigs in a lot of cases. And, you know, they're just doing it for fun. And for as far as they were concerned, well, you've got to go back to how it's produced, which is that I would put up auditions on the Voice Acting Alliance forums. People would send me audition lines. I would pick the people. I would send them the script and say, okay, here are your lines. Here's the script. This is your character. So specifically, just give me these lines. They would record those specific lines. And then I would gather all the lines together. When I was ready, I would go through scene by scene. I would mix all those lines together from people who never met each other, never talked to each other, never saw each other, didn't even know each other were in the story in many cases. And that was how Twin Stars got made, you know, the whole satellite audio drama approach, which from a modern perspective seems kind of primitive, but that's how we kind of had to do it back then because Skype really sucked. It wasn't like we could do it over Skype and it wasn't like I had a VPN as an option so I could have like a crystal clear audio quality coming in from multiple sources. If I were doing it today, I would probably do it something like we're doing right now, where each person is recording on their own machine. We do it live over Skype, and then I have the Skype recording, and I have the local audio recordings, which are the ones I actually use.
You heard it first here, kids. He said he's going to do it today.
Nice try, Jack. Anyway, thank you. No, I appreciate it. I know you're doing it because you loved it. And
I do. I love the stuff that you make, for sure.
And so as an end result, I mean, my inability to take Twin Stars to that next level where the story kind of needed to go, my inability to do that, made me shut down Kung Fu Action Theater entirely. Like I'd also kind of burnt out. I did it for 5 years, right? So I kind of reached that point with it where I had other things going on in my life. I had some personal stuff going on as well. And I basically said, you know, I'm going to take a break from this, and so I'm going to stop, and I never really went back to it. I think I did actually do at least one little Go story or so after that. That's why I say little Go is the beginning and the end. Sure. But then I think I did try one slight revival where I did a few new things, but generally speaking, Twin Stars was basically the end because I couldn't do more of it, and I knew that that's what everyone really wanted. And so every time I released something that wasn't Twin Stars, I felt really guilty. And so between the guilt and being kind of burnt out and everything else, I just said, nope, screw it. I'm just going to do a novel. And maybe if I can write novel versions of it, people will be happy. And I could even put audiobook versions up on my feed, I was thinking at one point. Sure. And so I tried writing the novel version. And I realized I sucked as a novelist in terms of my ability to tell a gripping, interesting story. My story was basically just the audio drama scripts with like narration added in and everything like that, or exposition added in. And so I said, nope, this is not working. And so I had to go back again. And I started researching, well, how do you write stories? And that became a long process of a couple years of research and studying that kind of thing, which I eventually, you know, brought together when I wrote How to Write Shonen Manga. And which included a whole bunch of different ideas I'd picked out and everything like that, and story structures, etc. And then it's eventually turned into other storybooks as well, because I'm kind of in the nonfiction mode at this point. It's funny, I'm so much in the process of getting out nonfiction, I still haven't gotten out any fiction yet, but I will eventually, I promise. I've written little bits of it, and I really do enjoy it. I actually enjoy writing fiction, I just haven't gotten back to it. And then, of course, I've still got Twin Stars hanging over my head, which, like, do I go back and try to write Twin Stars, or do I, and finish it? Because I think I could now. Or do I just go and do something else and, you know, just consider that part of my past? And that's a decision I really haven't been able to make. I'm still figuring that out.
Wow. It's similar to my issue with Biff Straker. Because Biff Straker's been on hiatus for way too long for the same reason. But one of it is, yes, again, that original person was the main character in there. So I had to go back and I re-edit it to remove her. And then put somebody else in. Actually, I was going to try to do the Lone Ranger thing where I was actually going to, I think I told you in the radio, original radio drama, the Lone Ranger, the actor who played the Lone Ranger on the radio died before he came to the studio, and they rewrote the scripts so that he got injured in an attack. And for like a month time, he just sort of grunted and made noises. And they had Tonto do all kinds of stuff. And then he learned to speak again, and it was a different actor. But because there was no repeats or anything from the radio, nobody remembered exactly what the original actor sounded like, and you could just move forward. So I was trying to do something like that, where I actually do have the character get damaged and her voice is hurt. And I was ready to play those original shows when I first got this sort of commandment from on high that everything that this person was in had to be gone. So I went back and I went, so I kept that little story plot part point, because I thought having that person injured was a good plot point. But then I ended up using her anyway all the way through for the beginning. So kind of saved me a little bit. But then the biggest problem I had was I hate producing. You know, there's some people who love to produce and love to spend the time doing that. I really hate it, because every time I take so much time producing, I'm just desperate to be out there writing more, you know? So I've been looking for producers, and every time somebody takes it, I don't know. See, the thing is with Biff Straker, I want to have all my own original sound effects for all the different things. And that's a massive undertaking. Especially when you consider that every world that he goes to has its own sort of sound, sonic, you know, thing. Everything is different. And so there's just, it's not like the cool thing about the Red Panda, like that Greg did, was he kept his sound effects really small. And he kept it really about the interplay between the characters, both that and Blackjack Justice. Yep. And you can tell it's kind of glaring at times when he has to do a lot of sound effects stuff, because it's not his forte, right? And yet, he, you know, he would put out two different shows a month. Like, it was incredible how many shows he would put out. He would have his friends come, and they would record, and then, like, every 2 weeks for a while, he had a new show out. And they would record four shows a shot. And then he slowed down about that. But my problem is I'm sitting there with Biff Straker. Now, I could say that it's a failure, but the truth of the matter is that I am coming back to it. It's just taking me a lot of time to do it, because I want to do a better job of it. I don't want to keep improving it as I go along. And now I have an opportunity where I may have a Hollywood actor doing it. So I'm actually going back and rewriting the first three or four episodes again to do sort of another relaunch of this, just because this sort of fairly well-known Hollywood actor may end up playing Biff Straker. I'm not going to say who at this point. I think I told you about it.
Who it is. Yeah. That's, we can talk about that after the show.
Well, exactly. I can't say anything, because, you know, we're in contract negotiations and all that kind of stuff. So,
but that would be awesome if he decides to come in. That truly would.
That'd be fantastic. So that's where I'm at. Is that, and I'm in the same place with the other. Like, I wrote Biff Straker literally 30 years ago. Like, it was like the first script I ever wrote, and I've already rebooted it, just like Red Panda rebooted that, because it was more comedic than anything else. And then I wanted to play it straight. So then also I'm waiting to redo the reboot of Philippa Graves, which is my detective serial. And the thing is, and I'm kind of like Dawn in this way, is like, the longer I leave it, the more clear my Philippa Graves dystopic world becomes. And I get really cool ideas that are just percolating in the background, but I can't leave it for too much longer, because it's been 30 years and I'm really anxious to get going, and I have a great actress who's ready to play it. And so she asks every once in a while. So I really have to sit down and do that.
Right. And well, yeah, none of us are spring chickens anymore. We're all getting up there. So at this point, if you if you've had the story for 30 years, yeah, it's time to get it out.
And here's the other thing I want to say to Don. Like you were saying, you know, what's the biggest, if you could tell your younger self, I would say fail earlier. Because I didn't do as much when I was in my 20s. I was trying to be a good husband. My wife didn't care about my writing. And so I literally put it away for over a decade and hated myself for it. And I should have tried harder earlier on, because I really think that it's one of those things, though, that if we dug into it earlier on, we'd be further ahead now.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. Actually, I wish that I had made the more honest effort to study writing earlier in my life. That's the thing. I mean, I dabbled at it back at the university. I took creative writing classes back at the university back when I, in like the early 90s when I was there. I went to the University of Windsor. That's where I met Dawn. But I got to say, those creative writing classes were complete shit. And in fact, looking back on, they were, well, I know they're worse than shit, really, because they were the kind of creative writing classes where the professor just has everyone write something short, and then you come in and you just do have a reading circle and you read and people take turns, and then it's like, oh, that's very nice, and oh yes, that's everyone right. Say something nice about it, and then you move on, and
it's more that, writing therapy than learning how to write.
Exactly right. Yeah. And
I don't think it's even that. Like I remember. When Rob took it, we had another friend who took creative writing too. And basically all it ended up being was a circle jerk because everybody was afraid to give real comments because they thought, oh, then he'll be mean to my stuff.
Exactly. But that's exactly what happened. And also, and this is something I've discovered, like going hardcore into researching how to tell stories and such. Your average creative writing teacher, and I would probably hazard like 90 to 95% of them have no fucking clue what a story actually is. Like they don't know it from a technical aspect.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They only know it from, well, you write stuff and it's either a story or it's not. And it comes out of your heart or whatever. Cause they tend to follow it from the, we'll call it the artist's point of view, that stories are a creative artistic thing that comes from your soul. And Don and I had a conversation about this the other day. And the truth is, no, writing is also a science. There is a science to all of this. And it's very, very, and I mean like digging, you have to dig deep before you find any books where any, you know, writing teachers even, and I'm even talking about like the classics, will actually talk about what a story actually is and how you put one together and what you need to do to, for example, make your audience feel something.
Right.
Yeah. Do you realize how few books on writing actually are about how you make your audience actually feel emotions? Yes, like the answer is like a tiny, tiny amount.
Right.
Because all of them are, it's like they're afraid to. It's like, well, I don't want to, you know, talk about that. But writing, good writing is all about playing with your audience's emotions.
For sure.
Being a good storyteller is about like almost manipulating your audience's emotions like a puppeteer, like playing them like a musical instrument. And the best writers do that, but they do it almost all instinctively because no one fucking teaches them how to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And it's interesting because I remember Harry Chapin said he has no illusions that, you know, being a writer of songs, for example, is anything different than being a bricklayer or being somebody who makes wooden furniture. You have to know the pieces. It's an artisan kind of thing. You have to be able to shape things and put things together in a very specific way to be able to produce something that's effective that way. And you're right. Exactly. There's very few ways. It'd be interesting, you know, if you had, you know, an article on your blog, which would be Rob's best list for writing. And be all the various different sources that you would suggest. Read this, but only read this for character development. Read this, but only read this because it tells you the 42 plots that you can work from. You know, like all those kinds of things. That would be a really, I would like that article if you could come put that together.
I'll look into that. I'll look into that. I have to think about it a little bit. But because I've gotten my stuff not just from books, but from different sources and thinking around.
Sure.
But yeah, actually,
and
definitely.
And that could be added too, right?
Because Yeah.
Some of those things are various different websites that you've found, which have been amazing for that reason, too.
Because the thing is, I just go back to myself because it's all about me. Sorry. Anyway, I wish my younger self, because I wish there were the type of books, because I'm the kind of person that I need to understand the structure. I need to understand that bricklaying thing so I can build on it and then build an actual story using that framework. Understand what works and what doesn't and all those things. And there was nothing there for my younger self to learn. Like, there was nothing there. I'm sure there may have been one or two books that I could have possibly learned some of that stuff from. But even the older books I've read, most of them, there are bits and pieces here and there. But I'm going to be blunt. There is no one golden book, not even mine, really, that teaches about how to do all the stuff that a person needs to know to be a good basic storyteller. Like, here's how you write a basic story. I hope to write that book someday. I really do, actually. That's on my list as well. The book I've written on storytelling is actually very good and covers a lot of it. But since I wrote that book, I've even uncovered even more stuff that I was like, oh, I wish I'd included that and that and that. But anyway, the book that's out there, go check it out, folks. All the Right Moves. Very good book. But but the point is that if my younger self had a good teacher that could have taught me some of this stuff or things like that, when it came time to doing Twin Stars, that I wouldn't have stumbled. I would have actually been able to do this kind of thing. So again, if I could tell my younger self anything, it would have been to write more and put in the effort and just stop dicking around and actually do whatever it took to learn what writing really is and to become a better storyteller. And as for what Twin Stars itself, I should finish that off. What did I learn from doing Twin Stars or not doing it, as the case may be? I learned a lot about storytelling and such, but the failure aspect of it taught me that sometimes you do have to give up. Sometimes if it's just not there, it's just not there, and you have to do something else. Mm-hmm. Also, planning ahead is not a bad idea. like I said, I did know the ending. I still do. I know the ending of Twin Stars, but having a more solid outline might have helped me a little bit too. So I wasn't fumbling around as much as I was. And I think that would have produced a stronger and better show.
Cool.
All right. So okay. That's enough for me. All right. I'm sure I'll think of something else that I screwed up sooner or later.
You bring up something that I thought is interesting, because if you want to learn how to write, I found the best thing to do is go to school and study psychology.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, actually, I've learned a huge amount of what really works for writing and that from studying psychology, a little bit of neuroscience, and you know what else? Marketing. Oh my God. Yeah. Look, marketers are spending billions, if not trillions of dollars every year trying to understand how people think and how to research people's emotions and what will trigger emotions and how to make people feel things. You know, the stuff that writers are supposed to be doing in their stories. They're spending billions doing research, and then the best of that stuff gets shared by various marketing books. So I find you know what I found? Two things that have taught me a lot about storytelling. I'm going to say one is marketing, okay? Mm-hmm. And the other thing, which is going to sound really weird, is magic. I've actually been studying a little bit about magic and the thinking and philosophy behind how magic works. And I don't mean like D&D magic or Tolkien. I'm talking about Penn and Teller magic and David Copperfield and the people who are basically just tricking your ass. That's who I'm talking about. and because you got to understand that magic, as Penn and Teller, who I'm huge fans of, as I've mentioned many times before, will talk about how what the audience perceives and what's really going on are two completely different things.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as Teller said, in something I was listening to not too long ago, said that actually it's good that the audience can't see, because the stuff behind the curtain is really, really ugly. If they could see it, they'd realize that it's really all cheap and basic and just not very interesting and not very fun to watch in a lot of cases. It's all about controlling the audience perceptions and controlling what the audience thinks they're seeing and thinks they're perceiving while you're really doing something else.
They're doing a masterclass right now, you know that?
They've already done one, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You can go and get their masterclass on this.
Yep, it costs about $200, I think, or $250 or something like that. Yep. I've actually been seriously tempted, actually.
I've got the Masterclass series. It is $200, but you can get everything.
Yeah.
It's not just that. So that's what happens. So I'm going through Neil Gaiman right now talking about writing.
I bet he's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, he is pretty interesting stuff. And there's a bunch of people in there. This guy got Hans Zimmer talking about music. So
that would be fun.
Here's one of the things being a good writer is that you could understand how to create emotion by understanding how to create sound scores for a movie.
Oh, that's an interesting point of view. Okay, I can see that.
So it's not just one thing. There's just anything that connects you to human experience. You want to find out about how to be able to connect people? Find out about people who do live clowning.
Oh, yeah.
Because they got to know exactly how to make people laugh, when to make people laugh, when to hold them. I mean, and I'm not just saying just go with that. I'm just saying there. If you take a look at any elements of entertainment that grab people's attention and hold it for any length of time, there are kernels of secrets in there, just like there is understanding comics, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, absolutely. I'm with you 100%. The people that do clowning, the people, as I said, magic, music, comedy, comedians. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The stuff that they know and some of their skills are amazing. Stand-up.
Yeah. Stand-up is incredible, right?
Because
there's a story that's, you know, good stand-up. They set up a story and then they have that callback aspect, right? That requires you, and there's that sense of realization, right? That's what the callback is, why it's so funny. It's such a relief. It's just like, I know. It's just like being let in on the joke, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're just like, oh, this is what they're talking about the whole time. It's that same feeling you get when you figure out a mystery and you think you're so smart for doing so.
Actually, you want to know someone who actually does a really good version of that? I was just watching on Netflix, actually. You can find two comic specials by a comic named Ali Wong, who's kind of trendy right now. The first of them, because my wife and I watched the first one a couple of weeks back, and we were killing ourselves. It's about an hour long.
Anaconda Mom or something like
that. Yeah, exactly. Well, she did two. The second one, I think, is Tiger Mom. And, well, actually, she's pregnant both times. That's the weird thing. But they're different kids inside her.
That's right.
Because she did it like 2 years apart.
That's
but she's pregnant. Anyway, but the first one is actually like that. Like, I was watching it, and even as I'm watching it, I kind of realized what she was doing. I could see the setups that she was doing, and she brings it all back around at the end to this giant punchline at the end. And it's like, I was really impressed. I'm like, wow, this woman really knows what she's doing.
Yep.
But she's been a Hollywood sitcom and joke writer for a while, so she has the skills. Like, she'd learned it from, like, pros. And you could tell.
Yeah. And it's people like Steve Martin, same thing. He started off writing as well. So I think writing is a good aspect. Conan O'Brien wrote for The Simpsons in the first couple of seasons of The Simpsons. So I think understanding good jokes and stuff like that, they had to go back and get the basics. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's probably going to be next on my list, is trying to understand comedy, because I haven't gotten there yet. I've been focused on magic and marketing and such, But going back to my point, though, marketing, will teach you amazing amounts of about how humans think and how humans connect to things, how they connect to products and ideas and everything like that. It's astounding what marketing really knows.
Did you listen to the Terry O'Reilly series?
Of course.
Yeah. He's fantastic. Yeah. Well, people say, of course, but I tell people who are marketing people and they've never heard of it before. It is brilliant and one of the number one podcasts people should have been listening to. And he's got two or three of them out now, because the other ones are older, but one was like O'Reilly on Marketing or something like that was the first one.
Is he still doing them? Is he still doing one or another? I haven't listened to him in a bit.
I think it's hard to tell, because he's been putting up reruns on the podcast, so every once in a while. But I think he's still live. I'll have to go and look and see. But it's Under the Influence was his last one.
Under the Influence. And he used to do Age of Persuasion, wasn't it?
Age of Persuasion was like his second show, kind of.
It was the second show. Okay, and he's got a third since then?
Well, Under the Influence is his third one.
Oh, right? There was another one. Okay,
the first one was O'Reilly on advertising.
Okay.
And then he sort of finished that up, and now he's been working on Under the Influence.
And actually, I would actually credit, it was O'Reilly that really made me understand that marketing was everything. That marketing really, that how much they understand and how much they've learned. It was O'Reilly that I give a lot of credit to that And that's why I began like studying some of it. I've still only really scratched the surface on it. And I've read a couple of books on it and such and looked at different ways that they do it. There's a really good book called Influence by Robert Cialdini. I'll put a link in the show notes. That's considered, it's basically him letting you in on like the top seven ways marketers like mess with you. But the thing that's fascinating is that it's all based on psychology, going back to Don's point earlier. This is basically all the mechanisms that they've discovered in the human brain, the way we've evolved.
Right.
And so you're getting responses for that. Like what I mean is if you do this, the human brain will just automatically respond that way.
Right,
You know, humans like to think that we're in control and everything. The answer is no, we're not. We're usually running on autopilot. And if you know what the autopilot's buttons are, you can push them.
Right.
And you can get to do whatever you want them to. And it's amazing how some of it works and how simple some of it is. Like one of my favorites is that he knew this woman that was running a knick-knack shop. And she had, these were like seashell sculptures or something like that. Don't quote me on that, but they were something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And she had them and they never sold. They never sold. And tourists would come into this place all the time and they would never sell. And she even put them on sale. She pretty much reached the point of giving them away. And he's like, he's talking to her about it. And he said, no, you're doing this wrong. Okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to charge the highest price you can think of for each of them. And she's like, what? And he said, do it. And she's like, okay. So he comes back a couple weeks later to visit her shop. They're all gone. Because as soon as she charged like several times what the original price was, everyone thought they were valuable and bought them as fast as they could.
Yeah. This goes back to when I started to learn how to do computer consulting, my buddy, he was charging somebody, when he first started, he's charging them $15 an hour to install Windows.
Yep.
And I mean Windows 3.1. Yep. And then he would go install it and then give them an hour tutorial. And he got a lot of work because people didn't know that. He moved up to $50 an hour and the phone was ringing off the hook because people thought, well, this guy must obviously know what he's doing. If I'm going to pay $50 an hour. Now, he said he did have to know what he was doing, obviously. Yeah. But the truth is that it's that old story. People will value based upon what you place.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. You know, I found an interesting thing. That works on Amazon, too, because I've been selling my books on Amazon. And I actually lowered the price of my books for a bit. And wasn't getting that many sales. So I raised them and I started selling more.
You're crazy.
And it's now Amazon limits you. There is actually a limit to how high ebooks can go,
right?
Because they want to keep the prices down. But I learned this from other writers who had commented about that. You can really sell within limits. You can't charge like $1,000 or something for them, but you can sell your books for almost anything you want on Amazon.
Right.
People will either buy them or they won't. The price is usually not actually that big a motivator. The motivator is, do they want them or not?
Right.
Yeah. There's up to a certain price point, like, you know, maybe, you know, $50 or something like that. They'll kind of go either way. But if they want that knowledge, they're just willing to pay for it.
For sure.
And so that, you know, that's just human nature. Whereas so many people on Amazon are pricing them at the absolute bare bottom because they think that's the best way to compete. And that's the best way to sell as many copies. And it might depend on the genre. It might depend on the book and that. But I've noticed, at least for nonfiction mostly, no, it sells much better if you price them high, not low. Because it shows that somehow this is worth
something. That goes against what people normally think about stuff, like the whole Walmart mentality, right? Lower prices. Everyone wants lower prices. Yep. But the difference is, I think, is when you start looking at your creativity, people think there must be much more value than, you know, well, if I can get a cheaper price for an apple, everybody knows what an apple is.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So, yeah, it's fascinating how that works. Very interesting.
Well, it's the old thing in Japan for a long time, and I've seen them myself, that people will talk about the $100 apples or the $200 melons, and that's a real thing. That's absolutely true. But what they'll always leave out, though, is that those melons and those apples, which are very real, are special gift ones. They're not meant for everyday use. Because in Japanese culture, what you're supposed to do is when you go to visit your friend, or especially if you're visiting someone you're trying to make connections with or getting the good graces of, you have to take a gift with you. Okay? Mm. And that's what those super high priced fruit are for. That's what they're there for. But there's also a certain aspect of the sellers realized, well, no, the only reason these things have that value is because they charge like $200 for this damn apple. That's what makes it into a special item. Seriously.
That's amazing.
That's what's going on. Japanese aren't stupid.
Well, yeah, because don't you get into real trouble, though, if you start giving gifts in Japan? Doesn't it end up being a gift war of one way or another?
There is that small problem. Because if you give a gift, they are automatically obligated to give you back something else.
Right. Yeah.
But there's a catch. That's not just Japan. Cialdini talks about that in his book. That's called the rule of reciprocity.
Rule of reciprocity. I've heard of that.
Exactly.
Before, yes.
If you actually give anyone something, unless they're a sociopath of some kind, they will actually naturally feel obligated to return the favor. Mm. Now, and here's the weird thing they discovered. This is from Cialdini's book. We're not going to spend the whole time talking about Cialdini's book because we literally could. But one of the weird things they discovered was that the payback, it doesn't even have to be commensurate with the gift you actually give them. Okay? Cool. So, for example, they did a study, if I remember right. How did it go? I think they sent these teenagers around basically to act as door-to-door salesmen, okay? Mm-hmm. But what they did is they gave them a small gift, or just automatically. They gave the people to open the door and who answered one or two questions a small gift, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was just like a pen or something like that. It was really small, almost nothing. Then they asked them, okay, if they would be willing to go out and donate an hour of their time for neighborhood cleanup. Okay? If they gave them the pen, they almost all said yes.
Weird.
If they didn't give them the pen, most people said no.
That's amazing.
And it was just because some little thing had been given, so a rule of reciprocity was automatically created. They'd done you a favor, so you automatically have to do them a favor.
So this proves that this one podcaster, I remember years ago, I interviewed this podcaster thinking that he would interview me.
Right.
And he didn't.
Yeah.
And in fact, I sort of poked a bit at him saying, you know, it's kind of like something you expect. He was like, no, you don't, kind of thing. And I thought, oh, good. So this guy is a sociopath. And if you want to know who he is, I won't say it now, but if you go through my entire 700 episodes of the Sonic Society, you could probably figure it out. So there you go.
Why, is he the only one who doesn't have a show on the Sonic Society?
No, he doesn't anyway, but that hints out. Yeah, he doesn't have a show on the Sonic Society, but that's because he really didn't do audio drama. I interviewed a couple of people who didn't do audio drama, so there you go. That'll narrow it down.
Okay. there we go. So yeah, the rule of reciprocity. There's all these, like, as Cialdini refers to them, click whir mechanisms that are basically in people's heads. And if you read Cialdini's book, he'll explain how a lot of them work. And reading that, and there was another book called Wired for Story that I read by Lisa Kron that also really helped me understand exactly what stories are and how they fit into human psychology and human evolution. And we could do a whole podcast on that. And maybe I will at some point in the future. I'm not going to go into it too much now. Go read my book. Anyway, but the point is that it's a science. Like, really, storytelling is a science. And yet so few people actually either are willing to share that science or are confident to share it or even think about it. I mean, you will find, how to write a certain type of story formulas everywhere. Okay, but no one will really tell you why this formula works. They will just say, this is a formula that I've noticed. It seems to work, like the Save the Cat formula, for example. And that's great, but why does it work? Why is it this way? Yeah. And very few writers are capable of telling you that.
I'm just as frustrated about songwriting, too, that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I know there's obviously got to be a breakdown of exactly, like, you know, musicality-wise, what makes a really effective songs musically. But I can't find somebody who's... I mean, for years, I've been playing my own guitar, writing my own songs, looking for somebody to give me that, and they just sort of look at me blankly. But I'm like, no, there's got to be somebody out there who can talk about, you know, oh, well, if you raise to this point or if you lower to this point, you know, those kinds of things, it makes a difference, right?
There's just the science of songwriting, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of what you guys are talking about, it all comes down to cognitive dissonance.
Okay.
Okay.
How's that? Well, like, say the rule of reciprocity and all that. What cognitive dissonance is, and I think we've kind of hit on
you
it
should,
before.
You should go over it again, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big kind of, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts, it's complicated. But the easiest way to understand it is, to the back of your head, to your subconscious mind,
mm-hmm.
it's more important for people to think you're smart than for you to be smart. Or to think you're tough than to actually be tough, or to think you're strong than to be strong.
You're referring to other people.
Yeah.
Okay.
And cognitive dissonance is basically the little lies we tell ourselves to maintain what this subconscious self-image.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you'll get things like when it comes to marketing, one of the things that they discovered that exposure
mm-hmm.
equals affection. And
yep.
the way it works psychologically is your brain, which is dumb, our brains don't work right, they're stupid,
mm-hmm.
will see the same like ads for the same whatever over and over and over. And eventually the back of your head goes, well, we're looking at this all the time. Maybe because we like it. We must like it. We're always seeing this thing. We're always around it. Maybe we like it. And mm-hmm. that's why exposure makes you feel good. It makes you like something. Same thing when you talk reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy gave me something. He must like me. Do I like him? I don't know. If he likes me, I must like him. Maybe I do. And then that's how you build these connections.
Mm-hmm.
That goes back famously to remember his name? Benjamin Franklin.
Right.
How he used to deal with his enemies.
Okay, how did he deal with his enemies?
If there was somebody he was fighting with, what he would do is he'd borrow a book from the person he was enemies with.
Right.
And then he'd read it, bring it back, and mention, oh, thank you for lending me this. It was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And it would work because it would be that cognitive dissonance thing. Yes. That we have a lot of things in society like generosity and that it's built in. We're exposed to that at a young age. We're taught there's values, hospitality and stuff. If I hate you and I lend you something and you give it back, what happens is part of my brain goes, well, he brought it back. He's not that bad a guy, I guess. And the other part goes, well, I lent it to him. I guess maybe it's because I like him, I guess. I don't know. Why else would I do it? And then that would be the cognitive dissonance kicks in and it softens things up.
I've seen a version of that where the advice is if you want to get people to like you, not necessarily people that you're enemy, but get people to like you, ask them for advice. Right, if you ask them for advice, it shows you hold them in high esteem and they naturally start to think, oh, well, this person's pretty good. And then it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. You want to see the confusion on my students' faces. I tell them, you know what? The friends that you like are only friends because they're people who think like you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get this look on their face like, no, that's not true. It's like, oh, well, tell me one of the friends that you have absolutely nothing in common with and that you don't admire. And then they get stuck and they'll start saying something. It's like, yeah, but where'd you meet them? Oh, well, we were both playing soccer. So you both like soccer. Right. Oh, okay. So they must be good people. We're very narcissistic as a species. We look at people like, well, they think like me and I'm an awesome person. Therefore, they're great people. Right. You know, that's how it comes down to. So,
yeah, it really does. Well, you know, I always tell my students that human beings are inherently selfish. We don't do something that doesn't benefit us in some way.
Sure.
So yeah. Even the people we choose to hang out with are the result of people we benefit from in one way or another. If we don't benefit from them, the relationship ends. It doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is horribly, it produces reactions just like Jack is talking about. And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, tell me one of your friends that you hang out with that you don't benefit from the relationship.
Yeah. And on top of that, it goes even darker because the studies mm-hmm. show very clearly, especially for middle school kids and stuff like that, mm-hmm. the people you hang out, you will end up taking their values.
Yeah.
And it'll end up being the darker values too. So let's say you don't do drugs. Well, mm-hmm. if your buddy does drugs, the chances are, but if he becomes a really close friend, you're going to end up doing drugs.
Yep.
Because you're more likely to do drugs than you are to get him off of drugs.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it works in different ways. Remember, that's why private schools exist. They're right. for the children of the rich to hang out with the other children of the rich because they know that will most likely inspire them to be rich and give them the connections to be rich.
For sure. And that's also why you get all these, like, the Masons and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They're like-minded people that are going to try to be able to use those connections to be able to get themselves in a better situation, right? So
exactly, yeah. It's mm-hmm. everyone working as a team for mutual benefit.
So does this mean that because we're on this podcast together, we're reinforcing our failures?
No, I would argue it's the opposite. We're reinforcing the idea that we're not really failures. We have learned from them and that we are all successes and that we will all go on into the future and be more successful.
Actually, I would argue that what's happening is, no, Jack is kind of right, but it leads to what Rob is saying, because one of the values of failure, because it's like you guys were just saying, we tend to ruminate. We don't develop.
Yeah.
If you fail, if you totally crash and burn, it makes you have to rethink. It makes you have to get out of your comfort zone. It makes you have to try something different.
Mm.
And there's value in that.
Yeah, that's true.
For sure. That's
true. Yeah, definitely. All right, let's take a slightly different tack then. So since this is the 100th episode of the Department of Nerdly Affairs, Don, what do you think we have failed to do in this show? Like, what aspects of this show do you think are a failure compared to what you originally envisioned this show to be?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because my first instinct is, well, we failed to get Jack to turn into a Japanese comic fan.
Actually, yes. You know, I've got a comic that I think actually might do it. I actually have a manga that I think might do it. I'll be sending Jack a link later.
Gecko Common?
No. I found one. It's a Western, actually. It's called Red. It's called Red. What is it? There's a fuller name to it. Hold on. Give me just a sec. I'll pull it up.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Red, Living on the Edge, it's called. And it's actually it's basically a Western, but it's told from the point of view of an Indian. He's the last of his tribe who's kind of on a quest for revenge. It's kind of Tarantino-esque, but it's actually really cool. He meets a Japanese sniper who's a matchlock sniper, because this is like the really old West and everything. Wow. That's all the Japanese had at that point. And the two of them go on this quest with a gambling girl across the, you'd have to read it, but it's very, very cool.
Here's an interesting little nugget of history. Who was the first author to write a Western from the perspective of the natives?
Would that be Last of the Mohicans?
No, because that was still from the perspective of the trapper, not the, like, they were sympathetic, of course, but they wasn't from the perspective specifectically. It was L. Ron Hubbard, of all people.
Really?
And he wrote a book called Buckskin Brigades, and it's considered to be the one of the first one that came from the native, like the natives were the heroes in the perspective of them, for sure. He wrote a ton of pulp novels before
he did. He was a major pulpiteer. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote so many. He had like four different aliases, and he had to have an experimental typewriter, cuz normal typewriters would jam. He would write 120,000 word book in a weekend.
That's insane.
Now, I'm not saying they were good, because a lot of those pulp books weren't that good, but just simply writing as many books as that, you're going to have some hits somewhere down the line.
Yep, exactly. Right. Yeah. No, I've heard that. He was actually quite the pulp writer back in his day, yeah.
Surprising, yeah.
Yep. Anyway, so I got things slightly off track there, but yes. But Red, Living on the Edge, I'll send you the link. It's actually really good, and I'll stick a link in the show notes, folks, for you to check it out as well. So besides that, what do you think that we creatively failed to do with this podcast?
The Twilight Zone episode.
That's on the list. Yes, definitely.
That is it. Kind of ties in, because I don't think we've exactly failed at anything, because our whole point was we did this kind of as an excuse to talk to interesting people.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And we've done that, and I think we've come up with a lot of good points, but there's always something, again, there's always something more. Like, there's things that I don't consider exactly failures, but there are things we haven't done. Like, there's a lot of people that I would absolutely love to have a debate with that, like, you hear on other, but some of them won't because they're, like, super famous and stuff. But I think that's, I wouldn't say we've done anything that was a, I don't think we have any failings, just a lot of stuff we're still aspirational towards.
Okay. Yes, I think I could agree with that, actually. I mean, when I look back on it, besides the Twilight Zone episode, I don't think that we've exactly failed at anything in the show. I mean, when I first started the show, I didn't really have any particular major goals with it. My whole goal was basically just to hang out and have fun and chat about stuff and hopefully bring in some interesting people like Jack and others to enjoy with the conversation, really. I mean, I know a bunch of interesting people, and I thought that this would be a great show for you and I to hang out and talk with some of them. And if we brought in other people that we didn't know, like new people into the conversation, I thought that would be equally awesome.
Yeah.
So I guess I can't really say that there was a major failure with this show. I mean, actually, correction, there is one small thing that I wouldn't have minded. I guess I'm not sure whether it's borderline, whether I consider it a failure or not. And it goes back to what you were talking about way back when, about the different kinds of failures. I think on a personal creative level, I think this show is a success. I think that we've actually had a good time. We've thought about many topics. We've discussed many things that we might never have talked about before. Like, having these structured conversations on a regular basis has been great. It's been fantastic. But at the same time, on a commercial level, or I don't mean by money, by commercial, I mean in terms of just popularity and reaching an audience, that kind of thing, I think the show's actually been kind of a failure. And that's just my personal take on it. You may actually have a very different view. But I had hoped that, you know, because we were talking about so many interesting subjects, that we would reach a fairly broad audience with this. And I never expected to be the Nerdist. I never thought that this show would ever, you know, have like tens of thousands or 100,000 or a million listeners or something like that. It was nice to think about. But when we first started, I never thought, okay. But I thought we would have a steady build with the show. Like, I thought that we would probably have, you know, over the time it ran, we would slowly accrue more and more listeners, and maybe we'd get more feedback in our comment section, which is mostly, you know, the crickets hanging around. And a few dust bunnies. And that we would, we'd slowly build a community, and that we'd slowly build a community is probably the best way to put it. And one of at least somewhat decent size. But one thing that's actually happened with this podcast is that our audience, since maybe around like the teens or 20s or that, has stayed almost exactly the same size.
Right.
And by the way, I don't mean for that number, I don't mean five. Okay. I mean a little more. I mean six. And, you know, that's something that's always bugged me a little bit. Like that we are doing this fairly good content and everything, yet we don't seem to be able to attract, especially in the great age of podcasting, when everybody and their sister's cousin's dog's brother are literally starting podcasts right now. I don't know if you've noticed this. They literally are.
Yeah.
Like, it's harder to find people that don't have a podcast than people that do.
Well, this is the, you know, the reason why is that it's not a true crime podcast. If you called yourselves DNA, the true crime podcast, you'd have 10,000 listeners right away, because that is what's really hot right now. I don't know why, but it's ridiculously hot.
Well, that and celebrities hanging out with their friends. There's a lot of those. Because if you're a celebrity, especially if you're like a B or A lister, you know a ton of people in the industry. So you can just invite your friends on. It's like, hey, I'm going to have Will Smith on today, or going to have like, Benedict Cumberbatch or something like that on tomorrow. You know, whatever. That kind of stuff. And some of them do. Some of them have been doing that. And that's great. I mean, some of them are awesome. But, you know, I would have liked to actually have, let's just say the number is, but it's less than 100. And I would have actually liked to have more than that. I would have liked to at least have a few hundred people listening to us after 100 episodes of our own. Like that we, but it seems to be that people come in, they might listen to a few episodes, and then they leave. Like, it's amazing how steady our audience is. And I can tell it's not quite the same people. We've got some people dropping out and new people coming in, but it's exactly the same, almost exactly the same number. And has been for years. And Or maybe it's literally one person with like a couple dozen podcatchers. They're all just downloading the episode over and over again. But
somebody in North Taiwan is
exactly. My brother-in-law apparently has been listening to all of them. But his podcatcher is faulty, so he downloads exactly that many episodes every episode, and then it's just Jack and Jeff and a few other people. But now there are a few episodes that have had like much higher numbers. Like we've had, there are a few episodes. I think our most listened to episode is approaching almost 1,000 listens.
That's about the first 2 years time old. You had me. Is that right?
No. I'm sorry, Jack. No,
definitely not. Definitely.
Actually, do you know what our top episode is?
Probably that comic book writer.
Nope. No. Really? Actually, our top episode is all about Ultraman. The episode we did that's like 3 hours of us going through all the Ultraman episodes is actually our most popular episode.
That's crazy. Consider we were talking about Ultraman before we started recording. So it's...
Actually, here, I'll just bring it up and I will tell you. I will reveal before all exactly exactly what our most popular episodes are, so you can see exactly where we are. Give me a sec here. Just bring it up.
The Ultraman one is ironic because, as I recall, that's the first episode we completely pulled out of our ass at the last minute.
Yeah, we just made it up. We just made it up. the information is real. We didn't make up the content. But we really did just kind of, okay, so let's see. Top 10 episodes of all time. I think it's the 100th episode. We can talk about this so far. Okay, so here we go. Number one, DNA's podcast number 17, all about Ultraman, 823 listens. Wow. That's number 17. That means it was recorded over 2 years ago. And we're still only at 823.
Wow.
Number two at 542 listens is DNA podcast number 60, Chinese Web Novels with Jeremy Bai.
Yep.
And again, that's partly because he actually has a fairly large following. He's a web novel translator. And so he tweeted about this. He's even got a YouTube channel with a fair number of people and such. More than 542. They didn't bother to come over and listen to him, but whatever.
Number, that was a good show. I liked that one too.
It was. Yep, thanks. 496 listens, we have episode 4, Satanic Panic.
Wow, I was there.
Were you there for the first Satanic Panic?
We were talking about it afterwards then.
I think we were talking afterwards.
D&D. I can't remember if I was there or not. I was there for one of them, so.
The D&D one, which starts from that episode. It's kind of almost a sequel.
Yes.
That's the one.
That's it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, you are not in that one. That one's...
You are the weakest link, Jack. Goodbye. Yeah, exactly.
or is he in it? Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. At 486 listens, we have episode 58, Light Novels with Justice R. Stone.
So again,
he's got a following, and so he let people know, and so they drop by. 482 listens, we have episode 3, Nerdly Speculators, where we talk about how speculation drove the comic book market and the toy market and such. At 469 listens, we have episode 16, Exploring the Hero Pulps with Greg Taylor.
Cool.
So he would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He would be our 6th most popular episode, would be with Greg Taylor.
Cool.
Here we go. Our 7th most popular episode was episode 2, Audience Expectations. What audiences expect from stories and from et cetera. Mm-hmm. Number 8 would be Why You Shouldn't Be a Writer, episode 23. Episode 9 is Podcasting Audio Drama with Jack Ward.
Yay!
Episode 15.
So I'm in the top 10.
You are in the top 10, Jack. And number 10 is episode 21, Interview with Tim Eldred.
Oh, cool.
And the thing that most of these episodes have in common is the majority of them are within the first 20 episodes we did. And here we're at episode 100.
Oh, jeez.
But some of that's because they're so old, right? So people go back and listen to the first.
That's true. Yeah.
So there is that aspect of it. But even our number 10 is 460 listens. So what happens is people come, they listen to specific episodes, and then they're on their way. They almost never stick around. That is one of my great regrets about this podcast is that not enough that I plan to stop doing it or anything like that. That's not what I mean.
Let's hope not.
I'm not, you know, not crying about this or anything like that.
For sure.
But this is just simply the way it is that for whatever reason, our show is just a little bit too niche. We just don't seem to attract people for any length of time. Unless they're hardcore nerds or hardcore DNA agents, they don't stick around. They just listen for a little while and then they go on their way.
Hmm.
Do you think part of that is because even though this is like the age of the podcasting, most of the big podcasts have been ones that started off really early and got a big boost. Like I think about the Escape Pod and how big it got. And then I found out from somebody that one of the reasons it got so big was it got a big mention from Yahoo back in the day. And so then suddenly once it got that sort of that blessing, it moved on. And I think the same thing with Marc Maron, right? Like he's been doing it forever. But and being sort of a B-lister, like you said, I don't want to say he's a B-lister now. He's doing very well with his stuff. But originally, he probably would have called himself a B-lister comedian kind of thing that nobody would have appreciated to the same degree that he was hoping to get.
True.
I think eventually, because he'd been doing it so long and he got the right kind of bumps from various different people, not to mention President Obama shows up. I think once he had interviewed President Obama, I think he was hitting the stratosphere. I think
of course
things got really quiet, you know, weren't super quiet, but weren't huge until then. So you got to have those moments. And going back to your thing about marketing, you probably haven't put a lot of marketing into this show.
That is true, actually. That's something I have been considering, whether I should put a little bit of marketing out there. I have done a little bit, but recently, because I've been doing releasing some new books, I've been going back into what the different marketing services like Twitter, Facebook, etc., Google, what they offer and how much it costs and things like that. And I have considered actually, you know, maybe doing a Facebook campaign or something like that with some ads to possibly see if we could get in some more people, because I'm sure that some of it is just simply people don't know we exist.
Yeah, I mean, if you ran a commercial on the Nerdist or something like that,
you'd get a but a commercial on the Nerdist costs thousands of dollars, Jack.
You're sure of that?
Oh yeah, there's not. I mean, if they want to mention us, that's great, but they're not likely to. And
do you know it costs thousands of dollars for a commercial? Because it doesn't cost that much to get a commercial on Marc Maron.
Oh, maybe
$60 or something like that. It's ridiculously cheap, right? Really? So it depends on how long it is, of course. But if you get yourself a really popular or semi-popular podcast that does what you do and then have a commercial that either you can, you know, just send them some cool copy that you can do about it. I bet you'd get a couple of hundred people checking you out.
Okay, that's one of the things we'll do. I'll actually seriously look into it. You spend a few bucks and we'll see if we can drum up our listenership a little more, because hopefully the people listening to this, this will be a year from now or something like that, and there'll be a big community and they'll be like, what's Rob talking about? There's lots of people here.
There you go.
And maybe that'll be the result of the marketing advice Jack Ward just gave us, folks. That's probably where it came from, because he is a pro and he's been in this for a very long time. But you're right. We do basically no marketing. It's just been word of mouth and hoping people find us through searches and such. I've done a little bit here and there, but I've never found it really gave us much of a boost.
Right.
I've even tried putting some of our best of up on YouTube, for example, for listening, and that's gotten some listens. But it's not a whole lot. I think part of the problem is that also it is now the great age of podcasting, or at least there's a boom. So there's much more competition for people's ears at this point.
Right.
And it's been that way for a couple of years now. In a way, it's kind of sad we didn't do this a couple of years earlier. If we had, I think we would have been able to get an audience much faster while there was kind of a bit of a lull.
Yep.
And then now when I ask my students each fall, you know, how many of you listen to podcasts, it's gone from being a few years ago, it was like one or two people would raise their hands.
Right.
Now I'd say easily 3/4 of the class will raise their hands.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really has all changed. It's all shifted. It's mostly Joe Rogan's podcast, though.
It's true.
It is, actually. Well, it really
is. It's amazing how many people he has listened to his podcast. And it's, again, I think a lot of it has to do with his guests, right? So if you're a big fan of one guest, then you can come in sideways and listen to his podcast, and the next thing you know, you're catching a lot. And of course, all of his stuff is broken up into clips, like really, really viewable clips on YouTube. So like little 8-minute clips here and there that you can be able to do, which is harder to do with the stuff that you guys are doing, right? If you just broke up your show in a bunch of clips, it's not going to make any sense.
No.
Coherently in the same way, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I've thought about stuff like that, but it doesn't work. And neither Don or I are pretty enough to actually do the video thing. Although I've seen a few YouTubers that definitely are much uglier than us. But the point is that it probably is best they don't see us.
Well, I'm thinking the key in the internet age to marketing is starting a fight. So we just have to find someone and get into a fight. And you mentioned Joe Rogan. We can do that because I've been rocking the Tor Johnson look way longer than he has. Quit biting my style, man.
There you go. There we go. Start writing.
You just heard that, Joe Rogan. Don just called you out. There you go.
Exactly. There we go.
Yeah, this is the
now point. We just wait for the listens to roll in.
That's for sure. And
this is the point where we discover that Joe Rogan actually does listen to us. He's one of our few listeners.
I'm shocked. There's a guy I know that has done some audio drama for me, and he got into some trouble doing stand-up and ended up getting in front of the Human Rights Organization for it. And ended up having to pay like $18,000-$20,000 to somebody, which was really unfair in my opinion. But I want to go into that. And Joe Rogan mentions him, right? And I'm thinking, wow. Now he doesn't want to trade on his name because of all the bad things that happened to it, kind of thing. But I like that's something you should bounce off of, right? So anyway, unfortunately, he said what's really interesting is that the conservatives all came to him willing to pay him money if he would go and say the horrible things that they wanted him to say. And he's like, I'm not one of you. This is not what this was about, right? So,
right, exactly. Well, it's just like the conservatives have all, you know, rallied behind Peterson, but Jordan Peterson's not really the guy that they want him to be.
No, and that drives them crazy after a while. Yeah, he's as he's said many times, I've actually taken like a number of different assessments, and I come up as liberal, you know, and so
exactly. Kind of no, Peterson's very, he's definitely very much a liberal, but somehow he's one of the patron saints of conservatism, at least again, according to the left, but whatever.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, there's our thing, Don. We should actually start doing the politically incorrect episodes and make either the left or the right hate the hell out of us.
Yeah, do one time and one the other time, and that'll work perfectly.
Well, that's true.
What we do is we come up with personas, and then we have our conservative personas, and then we have the liberal personas do an episode of their show, which is nominally separate, complaining about the other guys.
Yeah, true.
There you go.
We both, so then it looks like
the
a
old
big
Stephen
fight.
Colbert thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Are you Stevie Colbert? Are you Stephen Colbert?
Because that hits upon one of the other things, if you want to talk about failure, is there's a lot of people that do great stuff, but it just never gets seen. It never gets like the press that other stuff does.
For sure.
Because I was thinking of that. One of the websites I go to that deals with like nerdly news did a little bit of a blurb that Stan Sakai's Usagi Yojimbo comic has been picked up by another company. And he said, and he's been doing it for a while and it's really good. And I'm thinking, the guy has been, and it's one guy doing this comic. It's been one story since the earliest days of when it was a backup in Albedo in the early 80s. He's done like, it's got to be around 250, 300 issues if you take all the different companies that did it.
More than that, dude. More than that.
It's up around 300, maybe a little more, a little less, but 300's a good conservative number on it there.
Okay.
This is one guy who's been doing it for all this time. It's a great story. It's one giant, epic, continuing story.
Oh, yeah.
He never gets any press. He never gets referenced. Any of the shows that talk about, you know, the comic book industry, never mention this guy. And he's this like super genius of the medium.
Wile E. Coyote super genius. That's great.
Not even and like I say, and it's just that idea. Now he makes a good living doing it, like, or at least he makes a living doing it. But it's that thing that's there's a couple guys like that always stuck with me. Same thing with Timothy Truman, brilliant cartoonist, brilliant illustrator, gets nowhere near the recognition he should. You talk about Dave Stevens was another one. Brilliant stuff. Never gets
any respect, you know, like Rodney Dangerfield.
That's right.
Kinda.
But except people will tell you, they'll tell you again press. And again, like people's like, people have no idea how luck just came into this.
It really
you know,
does.
Like, yeah. So it really does come down a lot of times, like the perfect character, the perfect story hits the audience at the perfect time, meets the right producer, meets, you know, all those things. They really do have to come together. And because you like you said, you can have people who have written a far better story earlier than that or whatever, and it just doesn't take off. And you're like, how is this thing the thing that everybody talks about? So
yeah, mm-hmm.
exactly.
And that goes back to something we mentioned at the beginning that's just makes life worse. Is that idea, how do you know when to give up? Well, you can say, well, I've done this for like a million years. It's got nowhere I should give up. Mm-hmm. But then the flip side of that is you never know when you're going to get that one thing that gets you that attention that actually gets you somewhere.
Very true. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, at some point we may have some guest on and that guest will like trigger a whole bunch of their followers to come listen to us and bang, suddenly we've got a couple thousand listeners. Or some topic or whatever. I mean, we never know if at any point, you know, this show may suddenly explode on us.
Or we get into a fist fight with Joe Rogan somewhere and then that gets a lot of press.
Exactly. And there we go. And I'll hold him down, John, you hit him.
Okay, I can do that.
But anyway, so yes, that's exactly true. I mean, like I said, on a personal level, I do actually consider the show a success. I mean, I've had fun doing it. I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
We're having fun right now. Duh, it's automatically a success as far as I'm concerned. That was that's something actually I learned from Scott McCloud from reading Understanding Comics, where he talks about that. It's like, what is success for you? Like, even if only five people read your comic, isn't that still a success?
Yeah. If they love it and they're waiting for it, then, you know, if you have that audience, it's important. I think it's funny. The Sonic Society really took off after we made that Firefly series.
There it is. Mm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
There was a big podcast that was, you know, wanting Firefly back called The Signal. I don't think it's running anymore, but it was like going forever trying to get people interested in bringing back Firefly. And then they heard that we were the very first audio drama at the time that had ever done our own fan version of Firefly, and they loved us. And suddenly the next thing you know, we're getting 1,000 here and 1,000 there added to the Sonic Society. At our high point, we had something like 20,000 a show listening. So that was great.
Yeah, that's really, I've noticed in my years of watching social media and this kind of stuff, that's generally how it really does work. In a lot of cases, the simplest way to actually get popularity is usually to piggyback off something that's actually popular.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sad, but it's true. I mean, in the end, Jeffrey Bridges, who did, what was it? What were they called? Not Circus 13. That was another one. Pendant Productions. There we go. He may have actually had the right idea. I mean, that dude, they basically just did a whole bunch of DC fan audio drama, and he built up a huge community, and he built up a huge audience and everything doing that.
Yeah.
And even if we want to talk about the Nerdist and all those shows, well, guess what? A lot of them make their, or at least made their splash, partly by talking about whatever is currently popular and hip in the nerd community. Like, one of the things we don't do is we don't do news. We're doing our topics because the idea is this is something that's supposed to last. This is something that you could listen to this in 5 years and hopefully you'll still get something out of it. Maybe, maybe not. Yeah. But most of there are episodes. And we made the conscious choice not to do the news stuff. But the truth is, if every episode started with, and here's the latest geek news or something like that.
Right.
I have a funny feeling we'd have a lot more listeners.
Probably. Well, and this is just to bring this back to the thing. everybody who complains that Hollywood doesn't do enough original stuff, this is the reason why. Because why if you go take a look at like audio downloads and stuff like that, they're all classic stories. Everybody wants to hear the latest version of Robin Hood. Everybody mm-hmm. wants to see the latest Batman rendered into an audio drama. They, you know what I mean? Yeah. People like what they like, and you know, the complaints like, well, where's all the new stuff from Hollywood? I'm sorry, you're the one not buying it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of new stuff out there, but people just aren't getting into it because they're all excited about the latest remake about something.
Yeah.
Very true. I mean, yeah, that's, I mean, occasionally new-ish stuff will come, but yeah, no, you're 100% right. I mean, but because people are very lazy.
Yeah.
We talked about that earlier. They don't want something new that's risky or challenging or anything like that. They want something that's safe, that they know they're probably going to enjoy, that's a fairly safe bet. And at least they know what Robin Hood is. And so they'll just keep mm-hmm. listening to Robin Hood or Sherlock Holmes or whatever audio dramas until the cows come home.
Well, this is what drives me crazy because I don't understand. Well, I understand now because we're talking about it, but it drives me crazy seeing all the remakes of these Disney cartoon classics with mm-hmm. quote unquote yeah. live action, right? So there's like, just now we're going to see the live action Lion King. It's not live action. Those aren't real lions. You know that, right? You know, like these things that people keep saying about this stuff, but everybody's excited that they're going to use like brand new animation on stories that have been very well known in the whole bit. And I sit there and I go, why would I spend any money to go and see this? But people are looking at me like, yeah. Are you kidding? You know, don't you know the songs? Yes. I've seen the original show many times. Mm-hmm. I could probably quote many of the songs and sing them, but that's the reason why people go, right? I like to see things that are new. I really do. And unfortunately, that often gets us in a lot of trouble.
Well, in the theater anyway, I mean, there is some hope on the horizon, at least as far as new stuff. I've noticed that Netflix, God bless their souls, for now anyway, have actually been making the point of trying to find new stuff.
Yes, they have.
They're sinking actual, like, serious cash into new productions and new story ideas and new TV series or new things. Just because they're like, well, we need content that's not just the same old. We need something that's going to make our mark. And so they're willing to pay the money for it. And it's paying off.
And also Netflix is the place where TV shows that are canceled go to live on.
Mm-hmm. For one more season.
They often at least do another season to try and finish off these shows that have been canceled on network shows. It's amazing to see. You know, even now, like, Lucifer has been put on, and mm-hmm. they've done, like, several episodes of Longmire, and, mm-hmm. or seasons, I should say, seasons of Longmire. There's been a ton of these shows, and you're thinking, this is a really fascinating, because nowhere else, I shouldn't say that, there have been a couple of places where a show flipped to a network, but not very often. Mm-hmm. From CBS mm-hmm. to NBC or something like that.
Well, back in the old days, they used to do that. No, because it was actually much more common back in the 70s and early 80s. Shows would mm-hmm. some... Because remember, a lot of these shows are actually being produced by a separate production company.
Right.
So if the show was popular, like, for example, The Bionic Woman, if I remember right, flipped networks. Its first season is on a different network. Was on, like, ABC, and then the other seasons, like there were two more, are on like NBC.
Oh, I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying it was even rare back then.
It was uncommon. You're right. It's definitely rarer and uncommon. Okay, I'd agree.
Yeah.
But that's a bad sign.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Netflix started, they did all kinds of weird, crazy stuff, but it was because they had to. And I think what you're seeing now is that there's more different kinds of Netflix. You get Netflix and Hulu and Crunchyroll and blah blah blah.
Yep.
The Amazon, reason they bring they redo like a show that was canceled because it's a ready made product, and you're starting to see them contract because there's more competition, so they start focusing on the things that work and the things that are already established. And I think you're going to see, I guess, the exciting inventive bottom of the on-demand market fallout soon.
I would,
because of that contracting,
I would argue not soon, and I would argue what, because a bunch of the Netflix contributors are still rising up, and they're all desperate to have their own content and their own brands and everything. And so I would say, no, we're actually kind of in a bit of a golden age right now, where Netflix is doing that to make sure that they keep their, because remember, they're the biggest. They still are.
Yeah.
And they're still trying, they're trying to maintain that status. They're still doing a ton of original stuff. I mean, stuff like Slasher that Jack was talking about before the show. And there's a lot of stuff that I've never even heard of on Netflix. It's like, what the hell? And then they're bringing in some of the best TV from other countries. Like, you're getting, like, there's like Middle Eastern, like, supernatural dramas, and there's like Brazilian soap operas and Argentinian stuff. And Taiwanese puppet shows, and there's all kinds of bizarre stuff that's popping up on Netflix because they're pulling from their international selection as well.
Right.
And that's fantastic. Like that. And then meanwhile, you know, Amazon Prime is over there and they're doing original series, and then Disney Plus is going to be doing a ton of original series, and Hulu's now got to up their game, and so they're going to be doing more stuff, and there's WB's network coming and they got to do original stuff.
And it's fascinating, too, because Netflix, if you notice all of their original stuff, the credits are like twice as long because they literally do voiceover for basically all their other language options, too. There's like six, eight different language options, which you won't see in the regular networks, right? Netflix is really looking towards an international relationship with story in ways that many of the others sort of thought of afterwards. If a show was a hit, then they would go hire somebody and get a Spanish version of that kind of thing.
Well, a lot of the other content providers, like even Disney Plus, for example, they're all just rolling it out for North America. And most of them only have the rights, depending on whether it's their own stuff or not, for North America.
Right.
And so they're very slowly. Now, Disney Plus will be a big, huge hit because Disney in the end, but globally, I mean.
Yeah.
But Netflix kind of, they have the first mover advantage. And as long as they can manage to hold it, they'll actually do quite well, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think people have gotten to a point that they're almost comfortable with what they have, which is why it's kind of terrifying, you know, things like Apple and stuff like that. They're not going anywhere, no matter how, you know, awful, you know, a product could come out. Everybody has gotten really comfortable with the places that they're going, and now we have these huge monopolies. So
Well, even Netflix is falling into that, right? They've been slowly jacking up their prices.
Yes,
and that's become for a long time they kept them pretty low out of the competition to get people on, but now let's say Netflix is probably the most expensive service out there.
Right.
I think maybe HBO Go is more expensive, but as far as looking at Prime and Hulu and whatever, no, Netflix is definitely the expensive. Prime is only like $7.99, if I remember right.
Right.
Hulu, if you're down in the States, I think it's like $5 or $6. Because we can't get it in Canada yet. I'm still waiting for it, but we still don't have it. Because Hulu has the Criterion Collection, so I've been wanting Hulu for ages, but we can't get it. Anyway, yes, I know there's VPNs and I can get it that way, but I'm not going to.
I don't even know what the Criterion Connection is.
The Criterion Collection?
Criterion
Collection is they are the ones who collect all the great films of the world and of history. And basically, it's a curated collection of all the greatest films. I just heard
about this, but they sell them on DVDs too, right?
Yes, they do.
Oh, yeah, so
they do.
I heard about this because of Mark Siegfried,
Cersei. Cerky or something like that.
He was talking about the history of science fiction, and he was pulling out these criteria. That's why I heard the name before. He was pulling these out, like, you need to get this version of Metropolis. It has an extra 30 minutes that they found and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Very cool. Very cool.
They are what you could call the perfect versions of all these films, like the best version that they could put together and put on DVD or Laserdisc or whatever. And they've got all the Kurosawa films, pretty much every Japanese film worth watching they've got, which is partly why I want access to it. And Hulu's got it. Hulu, at least the stuff that they've made available for on demand, Hulu actually has almost all of it, at least in the States.
Nice.
And they've got other stuff as well, and a lot of American classics as well. Well, once you become a classic, the Criterion Collection usually adds you in at some point.
Very cool.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a changing landscape out there, but I do think it's actually still a bit of a golden age. I really do.
Yep.
And I don't think, I don't think we're near the bottom yet.
I don't know. I think it's bronze, because I think the Disney thing is going to be kind of the big problem.
Maybe.
Think Disney won't work?
No, I think it will, and that'll be the end of it, because Disney has everything that everybody wants.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Not every. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Since the acquisition of Fox, yeah, they have everything everyone wants. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's going to be Disney and everyone else. Although Disney does have the disadvantage that they are Disney. So remember, they're breaking everything into Hulu, which they now own controlling interest of, and Disney. Disney Plus is only for G-rated and maybe PG stuff, period, because it's Disney brand, okay? Plus the Avengers, that's, you know, which, well, it's the PG category, and the Star Wars stuff. That's why they keep it PG. Mm-hmm. It's family entertainment. Everything else that's not family, like all the Fox stuff, that's going on Hulu.
Yeah, but it's still them.
It's still them, but it's still, they've broken it into two services, so that'll at least limit them a little bit, kind of, sort of. We'll see.
We hope.
We'll hope. Anyway, we should probably... Jerry, go.
Oh, I was going to say, because the irony of all of those like Netflix-esque on-demand channels is that people got into them because, like, it's better than cable. It's cheaper, too. But now if I want to see everything I want to see, I have to subscribe to 5 or 6 of them, which means I might as well just fucking keep cable at this point.
Well, that's something that one of my other friends always says, is that it's not going to be long before the cable companies will simply say, here, we'll give you a bundle. It'll be Netflix and Hulu and Disney Plus, and everything. It'll be like $60 a month or $80 a month or something like that. And that will actually be a good deal. Instead of selling you cable channels, they'll just sell you the packages.
Right.
In a bundle.
Yeah. Which is basically just a channel anyway, under a different name.
All on demand channels instead. And we'll throw in Crunchyroll for free.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of the way it is. Oh, well, anyway, we should bring this back to our show, and we should also bring this to an end. Not that the podcast is ending, folks. Don't worry. This is this may be about our, you know, greatest creative failures, but this show is also about going forward into the future.
Oh, no, you were just announcing that you got bought up by Disney.
Shut up, dude. That's the truth.
That's what this whole show is. It's just...
Okay, fine, folks.
Somebody call security!
Flip it over to the other side and hear the real truth. Do it right now.
Okay. And as an end result, okay, yes, he's right, dude. We got bought up by Disney.
But then so did you while you were listening.
There's going to be no more swearing for the rest of this show, for as long as it lasts. Although, actually, Disney, though, you know, they buy some stuff, and if it doesn't work out for them, just continue with the Disney idea, they do get rid of it. I mean, for example, they owned Power Rangers for a while. Yeah. They said, you know, we don't know what to do with this. So they sold it to someone else.
Oh, really?
Disney isn't just a behemoth that grabs stuff. If it's not working out for them, they do get rid of stuff, too.
Wow.
Like, they do divest themselves of the stuff. Yeah. And there's something else I was just thinking of that Disney bought and then they got rid of. Oh, I can't remember what it is, but they do buy properties up. Oh, I know. They bought a whole ton of YouTube channels, like Epic Rap Battles of History and things like that. And then they weren't really working out, so Disney let the creators, like, buy themselves back. Basically, they bought themselves out.
Wow.
So Disney decided, this YouTube stuff's kind of crappy. It's not working out for us, so we're done. And I don't know exactly how that went down or what worked, but it did. So anyway, right. So let's end on a more positive note then. The one that's not about Disney. Sorry, they didn't really buy us out. I wish they did. I'd like to take my payday and go, but, you know, maybe in another 100 episodes. So, Don.
After our big showdown.
What do you see as the aspiration that we have for the next 100 episodes? Let's look towards the future. Is there anything you'd like to do thing you'd like to accomplish with this show during the next 100 episodes, besides have more listeners and more feedback and more discussions in our discussion area at obeythedna.com?
Well, I think it goes with what you're saying. Like, what I would like would be, more discussion, more people. Like, I think we've only ever gotten the equivalent of hate mail once, and that was Lothar, and he came on and did a show, and that was great. I'd like to see more of that, more dissenting opinions and more people with something that they're going to add and all that kind of thing.
Okay, I can see that. How about you, Jack? What would you like to see this show? Because you've been listening almost from the beginning, so how would you like to see this show evolve, or where would you like to see it go?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm just enjoying the ride, man. I really damn... Like, I mean, I sent you some suggestions here and there. I would love to hear those be put out. But I think
them. I know you will 200.
at some point. I really enjoy when you guys throw something at me that I haven't heard of before. Almost as much as like I enjoy when you do something I do know. Because the stuff that I haven't heard about before, I really end up learning something, and that's kind of cool. Like the light novel stuff, I didn't know anything about that. That was really fascinating. So,
okay, good. I'm glad you enjoyed that. Yeah. I find it fascinating too. So that's why I brought it on. To be honest, I'd like to take the show in a few new directions. I think that, by which I don't mean some wild and wacky sound effects or something. I mean. Or new co-host starting on. I would like to, explore some new topics that we haven't explored before. I think that we should probably push things a little bit. We still haven't gotten around to our romance episode, for example, which we've wanted to do for a long time, believe it or not. I just haven't found the right guest on. A lot of it's just about guests.
Yeah.
It's about finding people who will sit down and talk with us about that topic.
Right.
And we've had a few weird ones that we want to do but haven't managed to do. Like, we want to do a serial episode. And by the way, I don't mean cereal as in like serial killer. I mean cereal as in Cocoa Krispies.
For sure.
I always thought that would be a fascinating episode to do. We did a median food episode that mostly ended up being about McDonald's and other weird stuff like that. But I think doing one about like something like cereal mascots or something would be fun. Like, I think that we've got a whole huge list. We've got a whole giant list of stuff that we'd like to do at some point. Some of it is, like, there's been a couple experts on different topics that I'd like to talk about, but they are in Australia or they're in England, where thanks to the time zone thing, it actually makes it a little difficult for us to actually match up with them. There's been a number of British YouTubers who I thought, oh my God, I'd love to interview this person, and they're 6 hours time different than us.
Wow.
And it just makes it really tough for us to actually do a show with them. It's doable with West Coasters if they can finish in the early afternoon, because they're only like 3 hours behind, right? But anything beyond that gets pretty tough. Like, we have interviewed people in Taiwan. We did Hailing Chan was her name. I'm trying to remember. She basically came on and talked about Taiwanese comics. She was great. It was good, but
that was fascinating too.
But scheduling one that was about, and so with someone who's literally 12 hours apart was hell. Like, that was really tricky to pull off, but I really wanted to make that happen. So we did. And I think that's kind of it. I'm going to have to kind of push myself to actually come up with some more, to basically come up with a wider variety of guests. I guess really that's what it comes down to. I'd like to actually bring on more people and have a wider variety of guests in addition to the community stuff and everything else.
Yeah. Cause there's stuff. I can think of two episodes we've been trying to find an expert on that it amazes me that we can't, and that's Archie Comics and Harvey Comics.
Yeah.
You'd think somebody out there would we could get a hold of, but there's few people that have done any kind of like academic study, and they're really hard to get. Yeah,
we've actually tried writing to them, and they just don't write back to us. We've written to people who wrote like books on Archie and stuff, and they just don't respond, which is like, dude, you've got a book. Come on. I mean, if you don't, you want people to buy your book? Promote your book. Come on the show.
Exactly.
But no, we crickets, we don't hear back from them at all. Now, maybe that they're going to email addresses that don't get used anymore. Things like that happen. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm sure a number of times our guest people that we've approached have literally never gotten the message. Or it's just been a bad time and they're just like, oh, not right now. And then we just never get back to each other. That's happened a few times, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I've done a few follow-ups, and sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't. So, I mean, I guess bigger community, more weird topics, I think would be fun. And to keep having fun. I mean, that's really what I want this podcast to be. I want it to be fun for us and for fun for the listeners, because as soon as it stops being fun, this show is over.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, right? I mean, that's the real reality of this kind of podcast. Luckily, as Don and I are pretty good at entertaining each other, even if no one else is listening. So, that's kind of the way it works. So on that note, I want to thank everyone who's listened to this episode, and I want to especially thank our longtime listeners. the slightly less than 100 of you who have basically been coming or going from our podcast for maybe even a whole 100 episodes. We really appreciate it, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for listening to our show and for being part of this. Even though we haven't been hearing from you, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, at obeythedana.com, I think that just knowing that you are listening out there by being able to see your downloads and the statistics, and that has been one of the things that's kept the show going and really is appreciated.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say, Don, before we go?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that from the beginning, since something came up beginning of the show, I really do think that Gilbert Gottfried will do an excellent job as Biff Straker.
Now you've let the cat out of the bag. Damn it.
That was your chance to do a Gilbert Gottfried as Biff Straker impression, Jack. I know you loved your... Well, you know. Okay, well, I could totally see that. Actually, you want to know what? You want to hear something really creepy sometime? Go find a YouTube clip of Gilbert Gottfried talking like a normal person. Because remember, that's a character he does.
Really?
That's a character he does, yeah. It's
if you hear him talking by like a normal person, it's almost creepy because you're so used to him as the character. Hearing him talk as a normal person is just odd.
It is. It's very strange. I know. I've seen it. Yeah.
Okay. Any final words, Jack? Wow. Since you are our number one listener and an honorary third host, I will give you the final word.
Oh, well, thank you. I just want to hear the next 100. Thanks so much for letting me be a part of this 100. It was such an honor, guys. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to meeting Don face to face, because I was just saying to Rob that, you know, you guys chatting with you and getting to know you inside and outside of the show afterwards, it's been a great friendship.
Wow, thanks, man. Yeah. And someday you'll meet Don face to face and we'll regret it like I have.
Yeah, he's I'm not lying about that Tor Johnson thing. I'm really not.
Look out, Joe Rogan.
Okay, there we go. Maybe that's our problem. We should have done the video thing. All right, so thanks, folks. Thanks for listening. Good night. God bless. And tune in for episode 101 in 2 weeks. Good night.
Good night. Mm.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you'd like to hear more or join the conversation, come visit us at obeythedna.com. You can also find us on iTunes or whatever fine podcast site forgot to lock their back door. So until next time, remember that to master the nerdly arts takes time, practice, and enough Coca-Cola to drop a rhino. See ya!